For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford, in the cave with me, your favorite troglodytes, Mr. Mark Tuttle and Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. And, you know, for a couple of cave dwellers, these guys have a real habit of sending texts one after another after another.
And they all,
that's okay. They all seem to have attachments to them, and they're attachments with long articles and book ideas and things like that, and things that, quite frankly, since I'm not in the troglodyte brotherhood, you know, some of these things go a little over my head, but, you know, on occasion there'll be one that I might actually understand. And so I grab them and I take them and I read them when I can. And the one that came through this week was from a friend of the show's, Dr. David Evil. And the title was "A True Antagonist for a Broken World, Faith in a Secular Age." And I got to thinking about that. Where is faith going here in the 21st century? Guys, what do we do?
Well, you know, I think the question goes more directly to the question of where's the church going here in the 21st century? And, you know, and what is the role of the church in any age? You know, to a certain extent, the church is supposed to be, as the title says, a true antagonist to the world. You know, I love asking my kids this question, and I teach fifth grade faith formation. I ask them, who is the ruler of this world? Because there's really two answers. And I think as a Catholic, we have to keep that in mind, that there's two answers to this. On the one hand, yes, the creator of the universe is God, but we're told that the ruler of this world is actually Satan.
Yeah, it's funny. I was filling in earlier this week, teaching an RCIA class, and part of the first chapter we talked about was the creation of the world, and that was one of the first things I pointed out is, let's remember who this world was given dominion over to, which is Satan, the great accuser.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the big illusions that we have growing up in today's day and age. You know, I think we get used to the idea that, well, you know, everybody's basically good and the world's basically good and we all have it good. And so we lose sight of, no, you know, honestly, there's a lot of work that has to be done.
There's a lot of things that are broken.
And there's a lot at stake, exactly. The salvation of the world is truly at stake. And that's why the church is here.
Yeah, I was just, you know, thinking about some of the things that really do need to be addressed. And, you know, we call this secular, the world secular, meaning a sphere in which it's a religion-free zone. And it seems like a lot of the impulses in our culture currently, Mark, are to continue to kind of push religion further and further away. You look at statistics, one of the more recent ones that I saw on millennials, that really about a third of them now, 33% or so, right in that range, now espouse having no formal religion whatsoever. And that is triple or more than triple historically what that age group is typically held to. So there's a huge sort of falling out, not just falling out, but never even, right, the transmission of the faith to the next generation. Then think of the generation after them. Sometimes I've heard them called the I generation, right? I for iPhone, because they've grown up always knowing, you know, that sort of technology. But our ability to transmit the faith, our ability to for people to stay actively engaged in the faith and love the faith and practice the faith, all of which seems to be very, very daunting, very challenging. And a lot of the research, the current research, points to some pretty negative trends.
Yeah, when you speak of the crisis, I think one of the bigger aspects of the crisis, obviously it's alarming that you have 33% of the people kind of saying, or at least of this upcoming generation, saying they don't adhere to any, you know, any particular faith. They're the nones, the N-O-N-E-S's.
Right.
I think even more alarming, though, are the rest of the people. There's a large chunk of them that their connection to the faith is only nominal. You know, yeah, I go to church every once in a while. I'm a good person. You know, I believe in God. You know, the...
I think Al Cresta has a great catchphrase for it, which is people have been sacramentalized, meaning they've been baptized, but they've not been evangelized.
Right. Evangelized or catechized, or for that matter.
Yeah,
right.
Catechist is still... I mean, there was I think we're all very hopeful under Pope St. John Paul the Great, this revitalization of the catechesis of the next generation. The technology is made available in ways unprecedented historically, access to the great teachings of the church. Pope John Paul the Great was adding to those teachings, Benedict the 16th. Pope Francis has also made contributions as well. But it seems, I think I'm more and more pessimistic, though, about how what we're doing with these teachings and how are they impacting or changing or transforming our hearts and our minds for the glory of God. It seems like we have this treasure and we're not using the treasure, taking advantage of it.
Right, because on the one hand, yeah, you have the treasure, and the treasure's twofold. It's the teachings of the church, but also the unprecedented potential of our age right now to transmit it. You know, the communication technology that's out there is unheard of. And I often think, you know, could you imagine what the world would be like if a St. Paul or a St. Augustine lived now and had the advantages of Twitter, Facebook, you know, all of the modern means of communication? I think they'd be sending out something a little more substantial than Grumpy Cat.
Right. You know?
Which tends to be what those things get used for now. So, you know, in a few minutes, we're going to bring in Dr. Deevil to talk a little bit more about his article. But, you know, I think to frame this a little bit more, this is an age where there's a lot to be pessimistic about. And I think a lot of times we get a little caught up in the pessimism. So part of Dr. Deevil's article is an attempt to pull us out of that pessimism a little bit. Not in a rosy Pollyanna-ish sort of way, but in a here are your marching orders sort of way.
We're going to take stock. He's going to help us take stock. Let's have a realistic view of the lay of the land. We've got to have that first. And then from there, how do we move into action and hope? With that, you're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy. Stay tuned. When you come back, we're going to be joined by our guest, Dr. Deevil.
Think of all the media our young people are exposed to today. MTV, movies, what passes for entertainment on TV, song lyrics that are questionable or worse. Where do they hear the message that it's okay to be chaste and modest, or that it's not crazy to practice their faith, or to believe in a God who loves them and can forgive them no matter what they do? Catholic Radio is the answer. Be sure to tell your friends and relatives about Catholic Radio Indy.
You know us as Catholic Radio Indy, but we're so much more than just radio. We're a website, CatholicRadioIndy.org, with access to great Catholic resources, including podcasts of all our local programming, podcasts that have been downloaded from all 50 states and over 40 countries on 6 continents. Yes, we are Catholic Radio Indy, but thanks to your support, we're taking the gospel of Christ to the ends of the earth. Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Welcome back to The Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blanford, and with us we have special guest, Dr. David Deevil. Dr. David Deevil is Associate Professor of Catholic Studies at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. He is also the editor of Logos Magazine.
Love that.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Deevil.
Hey, thank you very much. It's good to be back.
Hey, we need to check on something first. It's a little bit of a personal question.
Yeah.
Have you begun to grow hair in the palm of your hands? Because to be an official Catholic Cave dweller, that's one of the first physical attributes we're going to be looking for. And you've been a guest enough times that I'm expecting the answer to be yes.
I'm going to say yes, but it's really more growing in my ears.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's part of becoming a little bit older. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm more the middle-aged man thing where they spend more time plucking hairs off of my ears and off of my eyebrows than they do on the top of my head. So.
I hear you. Yeah, I had to insist on a discount the last time I got a haircut because I'm like, look, you're putting in like one-tenth the effort of when I was 18.
Yeah. Well, it takes about 5 minutes for all the hair. Yeah,
exactly. Well, we're so glad to have you back in the Catholic Cave. You have I have to admit, just an exceptional article that came out earlier this week in Catholic World Report, and it's called A True Antagonist for a Broken World, Faith in a Secular Age. And I just think it's very poignant, and what I'd like us to do is to maybe let's spend a little bit of time kind of working our way through some of the themes that you identify throughout this. It's an article, but I also would say, as a way to encourage our listeners to go read it, it also is quite meditative with some of the different quotes that you include in it from Blessed John Henry Newman. But the first thing that caught my attention on your article, Dr. Deeville, is you talk about sort of this, you use this metaphor as the glass half full or the glass half empty as it pertains to the Holy Catholic faith right now. What were you getting at with that metaphor?
Well, I based this, it was originally a talk for a Newman on Tap group for Newman's feast day earlier this month, and I was thinking about how Newman thought about the state of the church and how that related to faith, and I thought of the old Gary Larson Far Side cartoon in which he has the four basic personality types. One person says the glass is half full, one says the glass is half empty, one gets confused and ends up saying, I forget what the question is, and the fourth guy says, hey, I ordered a cheeseburger. And I thought...
Okay, the third guy's me and the fourth guy's Mark.
Yeah, definitely. I am definitely the fourth guy, yes.
Well, I thought that sort of represented, you know, how we often feel about the way that the church is operating in the world. And so I went through at the beginning of the article and I talked about how when I came into the church 22 years ago, I had the feeling that the glass was half full and was filling because there was so much going on with John Paul the Great mm-hmm. and the people inspired by him. But as time moved on, I saw more of the difficulties in the church that persisted. Even during the reign of a great pope and even with some great young priests, new religious orders. And so I began to think, well, I don't know whether it's half full or half empty. And then over the last few years with the crises continuing to reoccur, the sexual crises, I think some of the difficulties with Pope Francis's pontificate, I started to go between, well, it's probably half empty, and maybe it's getting to be empty entirely, or I'm not sure what to think. Maybe I did order a cheeseburger.
You know, I had very similar experience, I think, coming in. I think you and I came into the church about the same time, probably about 20, 25 years ago or so. And, I remember at the time the term evangelical Catholicism was kind of topical mm-hmm. because there were all of these converts coming in. There were Scott Hahn, others coming in. There was a rebirth, at least within the American church, of scripture study. There seemed to be this melding of evangelical Protestantism and Catholicism going on that, yeah, I was highly optimistic about. And
John Richard Newhouse, right?
Exactly.
You point him out, Dr. Deeville.
And that seems like a bygone era at this point. It seems like that age is long gone.
That's correct. I mean, and you point out some good things about, you know, that there are more Catholics who are more involved in scripture study. There are people thinking about the liturgy. There are recoveries. And those things are still going on in some ways, but the confidence that this is really, you know, taking over the church or that the church is moving as a whole, I think, is really gone at this point.
It feels like it's fractured, right? It feels like there's I suppose like many other aspects of our lives, there's these spheres in which there's renewal and restoration, but yeah. It's very uneven, and it's in different places and in different ways. We have some advancement, but in other places it feels like there's also this falling away. And one of the statistics that you share in your article that is alarming. I had heard it or something similar to it before, but to read it again was a sharp and sad reminder that for every one convert coming into the Catholic Church, six are leaving.
That's right. Yeah, this was from a Pew Research study from a few years ago, and you can find it online. I've linked it in the article. And it is a good reminder. That's why I say, you know, my feeling is these days, precisely that, of fracturing and of things falling apart, the glass half empty and draining. And what I wanted to do was think about, well, is that always been the case? And I looked at Blessed Newman and looked at his assessment of the way things were in the 19th century, which was not easy. I mean, if you recall, many people thought that the papacy was over during the age of Napoleon. Napoleon kidnapped one of the popes.
Right, and, which is so hard to imagine by today's standards.
Right.
I mean, someone swooping in and taking Francis.
Right. The story is that one of the cardinals told Napoleon, you know, you need to give him back. And Napoleon said, I am going to destroy the church. And the cardinal said, well, you know, our bishops have tried to do that for 1,800 years and haven't. But what makes you think you're so special?
Right, exactly.
And so at the beginning of the 19th century, things were bad. And there was crisis in the middle and the end of the 19th century when Newman was writing. I mean, part of the reason why people were excited about Leo XIII was because they, too, saw that the church was losing hordes of people, particularly working class and the poor. And that's why Leo XIII's addresses on Catholic social thinking were so important, because they saw a crisis, too. And the more I thought about it, and the more I looked into my notes on what Newman would say at various points in his letters, the more I saw that he thought the church was always in this fractured place.
You know,
I mean, the times when the glass is half full and filling are kind of few and far between. And yet he felt that the church was what he called a true antagonist to this world. So that's kind of what I wanted to get at, was that the church doesn't have to be in exact perfect working order for God to work through it. Instead, it's as St. Paul says, that when I am weak, you know, then God is the one who is strong and will accomplish these things.
When you start your article, you start with reference to yourself as a convert, seeing these things coming into the church, and then you take St. John Newman's, his kind of observations as a convert himself. Are these types of things something that have to be seen through the eyes of a convert, or is there something particular about being a convert in the church that kind of opens your eyes to this sort of view of the church?
I'm not sure. I mean, in some ways, I want to say that maybe Catholics who have been, you know, that way from the cradle have an advantage, because they don't have any illusions from the get-go. That, you know, the church has always been there. But perhaps what's needed is that sense of history. And that's what I think Newman had, was this sense of the broad sweep of history and of the fact that God's providence is always working, and he's always working even in the midst of, you know, chaos. And not, you know, another line that people like to quote is Hilaire Belloc's about how he believes that the church is a divine institution, because if it weren't, it wouldn't have lasted for a fortnight. And I think that's a sort of Newmanian historical sense. And Belloc had it, and he was a cradle Catholic.
Yeah, I get the sense with Newman also that he had a strong sense of the patrimony of the faith to a certain extent. You know, you've got the church, you've got the politics, you've got popes, you've got bishops, but underlying all of that is a constancy of faith, a constancy of relationship with God, and a constancy that's provided by the sacraments that are only available in and through the church. And when you read Newman's writings, that seems to come clear almost as much as his broad sweep of history, as you mentioned.
That's correct. One of the things I highlighted was that, you know, we often think, and perhaps this is a convert weakness, we think, oh, once I get into the church, it's going to be, you know, all heaven from here on out. I found the truth. I found what the Lord wants me to do. And yet, Newman's Catholic career was punctuated by a number of failures, and I mentioned several of them in the article. I mean, one thing is, he saw the threat of secularism in his time, and he saw that universities were secularizing. And he thought to himself, you know, this would be a good opportunity to do something. And when the opportunity to found a Catholic university in Ireland came along, he jumped at it. And when he set it up, he worked on it for about 6 or 7 years. But ultimately, the Irish bishops didn't back him up, and the project ended up, in certain ways, a failure. The same thing with afterwards, he thought, well, then maybe if a Catholic university doesn't work, perhaps now is the time to establish an oratory, his religious house, in Oxford and do ministry to students there, Catholic students. Bishops and indeed the Pope didn't want him to do that because they said, oh, you know, you'll draw Catholic students to this non-Catholic university and it'll ultimately be bad. He was blocked three times from doing this. And he, you know, he reflected on it and he said, this is the difficulty. It's hard to be out of joint with the times. I think I have a work to do, you know, for England, for the faith, and yet I'm being blocked, and yet God overrules all. And so even in the midst of this, you know, sort of frankly, you know, he was angry that he was not allowed to do what he thought God wanted him to do. He nevertheless said, you know what, God has his own time, and maybe what I've tried to do now will be done in 100 years, and that's the way God works.
We're talking with Dr. David Deevil, Associate Professor of Catholic Studies at the University of St. Thomas, and we're talking a little bit about your assessment of the times, and you bring up you know, Blessed John Henry Newman's role with establishing the Catholic University. And as a professor, you know, you're kind of front and center on that stage now. We face a lot of the same challenges, very similar situation, rising secularism. What role do you see the Catholic universities today ideally playing, and what's kind of the situation on the ground as you see it?
Well, I think, you know, for a number of Catholic, you know, smaller Catholic colleges that have been established that want to have a holistic view, I think they're providing a lot of young, excited people with good formation to go out and take positions in Catholic schools and in other Catholic organizations. For Catholic universities that are of perhaps, shall we say, a more mixed character, I think that they still provide opportunities for people to learn about the faith and to be in an environment where the faith is at least practiced and preached and emphasized. And so I think that there's a mixed future for Catholic higher ed institutions. And I think there's a mixed future for higher education in general, so I think that's not different. But I think that's what many people need to think about, is new opportunities. That's what Newman did. He saw a new opportunity for a Catholic university, and when it didn't work out, he then decided that perhaps his game was, you know, at a secular university, or at least a university that was becoming secular, Oxford. So that's why, you know, that's why I'm always excited about new movements to establish Catholic ministries. Many of them are at, you know, what are called Newman Centers for Blessed John Henry. But I think that those are very smart things, because the vast majority of Catholic students are at secular universities. And I think if we can have some formation that is there, that is of a spiritual and an intellectual nature, I think that that will be a great boon for the next century.
Well, and I appreciate in your article, too, this lesson that I took away from some of these failures, or what seemed to be failures, of Blessed John Henry Newman, in particular with that founding of the attempt to fund that university in Ireland. And you talked a little bit about how we might have the right idea, but at the wrong time. Yeah. And what great humility it requires of us to come to that realization, because we feel like, hey, this is what God's calling me to do, and we just pour ourselves into it, right? And then we hit obstacles and resistance, and then ultimately we may reach what appears to be, you know, failure. And the humility that to come to that realization that, hey, I had the, you know, this was maybe the right idea, but at the wrong time. You talk about that maybe it's 100, might be even 100 years later, might be the right time for this particular project or idea. That to me is an important lesson for us now, because it can be incredibly frustrating to, in parish life, for example, to be involved in ministries or try to get new ministries going, and sometimes they just don't work out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Newman is, I mean, what's interesting about Newman is that he's actually very open. He acknowledges that many of the Protestant reformers had great ideas. But he says the problem is that they pushed ahead on those ideas when it wasn't the right time. And he says when you do that, you end up becoming a schismatic, or then maybe a heretic. You know,
right,
what
was, which are to be avoided.
You know, what was good was lost.
Right.
Well, I don't want to be a schismatic or a heretic, and I think that's what Newman did. He obeyed church authority when it was telling him no, even if he thought that this was the right idea. I mean, maybe it's not his line, but you know, the idea is that when God shuts a door, he often opens a window. And Newman just had to say, you know what, Lord, this is your church, this is your salvation history, and I play a part in it, but only a small part. So he had to keep adjusting to what God wanted. And along the way, think about the fact that maybe these failures were designed, you know, to test him and to forge him into a man who had real true faith that sees even in the dark. And oftentimes those personal failures and the failures of the church do seem like what he said in his great poem, The Pillars of Cloud, deep encircling gloom.
Right, yeah. Right, which is daunting to say the least.
Yeah, and you get a sense of the same sentiment from some of the remarks of Benedict XVI, that you know we're entering an age where the church is going to be, it's going to be smaller, it's going to be beset upon by the forces of the age, but ultimately because of that, the church is going to be stronger for it.
I think that's right. I mean, Benedict, you know, his famous lines were that there would be a sort of a smaller and purer church. And we would have to be divested of a lot of the stuff that we've accumulated over the centuries, the buildings and the institutions, because once they're hollowed out, they don't really serve our purpose, but instead they weigh us down. And I think Benedict is a very Newmanian thinker in that regard.
Well, that harkens to, at least in the certain parts of the U.S., where there are just some dioceses and archdioceses where they're just closing dozens or sometimes hundreds of parishes, right? I think of like Boston, New York, for example, are areas where there's been that hollowing out, as you've talked about. And so, but it seems also though, I mean, so you have, it seems like where Christendom has flourished historically, that's where we're seeing perhaps the greatest sort of draining, if you will. Yeah. Meanwhile, say the continent of Africa, you see a surge in terms of the faith and the number of not just converts but baptized.
That's right. I mean, Newman talked about the fact that Christendom, this sort of organized reality of sort of this backbone of Christian society, was failing, that we were coming on a kind of secular age. And while he lamented the fact, you don't necessarily want people to no longer have those basic moral and spiritual ideas in the back of their head. At the same time, he thought that the church doesn't necessarily benefit from a lot of people, you know, doing half-hearted faith. Secular age forces you, when it's no longer cool or socially acceptable, to say, do I really believe what Christ teaches through his Holy Catholic Church? So he saw it as, I think, a great opportunity. And Africa has no Christendom attached to it, and yet, as you point out, that's where things are growing, where there's a real choice.
You know, this notion of Christendom, this notion of a Christian culture where just sort of Christianity is in the air. I had a friend who, he was a businessman, worked for an Italian company, so he would often go to Rome. And he said, you know, I love going to Rome because, you know, everywhere you go, you just sort of see and feel Catholicism. He said, it's a real shame that the people that live there don't actually practice Catholicism. And,
Ouch.
Yeah, exactly. And you sort of get this feeling of, okay, that's what the idea of Christendom is there really still vestiges of Christendom, or is that just sort of a dead idea, or is it a dying idea? Was it even a positive idea to begin with? I mean, what's sort of your take on this whole notion of Christendom?
Yeah, I think that it's largely dying. I mean, we've broken down all sorts of concepts of, yeah, I mean, we're kind of losing almost natural law in a way, where in our culture it's now become controversial to say that there are men and women. You know, now New York State has introduced legislation so that there are non-binary genders that you can put on birth. I mean, we've kind of lost all of these conceptions. And again, it's in many ways terrifying. It's terrifying to me to live in this kind of world. It's terrifying to think about what my kids are, are going to face. But at the same time, that's the world that, that the church came into being in. It was a Roman world where even the old paganism had kind of died, and there was a kind of emptiness, and there was lots of hatred and hostility to the faith. And again, Newman thinks that, you know, this is terrible from a human standpoint, but on the other hand, there's something that's remarkably hopeful about it, because now people don't have the sort of the baggage, if you will. Many of them don't even know anything about Christianity other than a few sort of stereotypes they've had. And so there's a way in which teaching them about Christ and the faith is in some ways fresh again.
Well, that's such an interesting point, and that's been my experience too, is a lot of, especially younger people, the nuns, the N-O-N-E-S, not the N-U-N-N-S, but the nuns typically have those, and that's the group that espouses to have really no religious affiliation. What they do know of Christianity, much less more specifically Catholicism, does tend to be sort of urban legend mixed in with a little bit of folklore, sprinkled with a little bit of imagination, you know, and then a little bit of and not particularly positive either, you know, more of glad we're sort of throwing, you know, throwing that off our shoulders and leaving that behind, because it freights with it a lot of different problems.
That's right. And I think this is the thing, is that the falling away of all of this, you know, sort of extra Christendom, half-hearted, nominal Catholic Christian faith is actually a good thing, because that's not going to attract a nun, you know, somebody who has no faith. What they're going to be attracted by is going to be a wholehearted faith that is shown in life and expressed in beautiful liturgy and lives of prayer and service. And that, so, you know, to get rid of some of this baggage is, I think, not a bad thing. I mean, when I came into the church, in many ways, you know, in the mid-90s, many people would say, oh, well, you must have had, you know, influence by Catholic friends or, you know, the parish. And I said, no, I didn't. My impression was that many Catholics didn't really believe. And I think that was unfair on one level, but on another, there were a lot of half-hearted ones. But I think, you know, would I have discovered the faith earlier if there had been parishes that were running at sort of full steam, full wholehearted discipleship? I think it's more likely that I would have taken the faith seriously because of people rather than simply reading my way into it.
You know, you bring up kind of what's the flip side of the coin of, you know, people say there is no such thing as a spiritual vacuum. And I think people mean, well, you know, once Christianity leaves, all sorts of bad spiritual forces are going to come and take over the void. But the opposite is true as well. In order for Christianity to be able to be re-injected, you've got to kind of get rid of the dross and the stuff that's occupying that spiritual space. And in a lot of times, yeah, it's sort of this dead vestige of, dead vestiges of Christendom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we look, I mean, it is, like I say, it's scary to me to see the numbers of people dropping, but when they don't really believe, you know, I want to say also that Newman was greatly emphatic on people's conscience. If they, in their consciences, don't believe any of this stuff, you know, if they leave the church, it is sad, but the answer is not to say, oh, please, 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 please stay. It's to then, you know, approach them again with the whole message. And, you know, and if they leave, they leave. But let's have people who really affirm the faith, or who at least are trying to affirm the faith, because that's going to be what people are attracted to, is a place in which there's room for sinners, but there's also the sense that people are really seeking Christ, who already sought them in the beginning.
Yeah, there's not a lot of room for complacency and mediocrity, right? It's a hospital. The church is a hospital for sinners, but sinners who are striving after what? Salvation, right? We recognize we're fallen and we need God's grace and we need each other, but we're trying, you know, and to the part of what I see, to your point, Mark, about this sort of spiritual vacuum, it seems that a lot of this sort of post-modernity the culture is quickly trying all sorts of things that seem to have fairly quick dead ends with lots of painful consequences, like, for example, a hookup culture. To me, it seems a hookup culture as a way in which to live out one's sexuality is fraught with not just ultimately pain and brokenheartedness, but it's a dead end and will bear bad fruit at first and then no fruit at all after much time. So it's when those sorts of things sort of run their course, if you will, creates those opportunities to present something beautiful like the theology of the body, to sort of restore and re-engage the culture once it's moved in. I mean, I've heard this term, and I don't know, Dr. Deevil, if you've heard this term, liquid modernity, and what it sort of points at. Unpack that term for us just a little bit, if you would.
Yeah, it's a phrase, I believe it was one of the Canadian Catholic philosopher, Charles Taylor, who used that phrase first, if I'm not mistaken. But his point was that all of the things that were solid in modernity are now liquid. We think of things only in terms of individuals and their desires. And as we know, individuals' desires tend to be fleeting. The hookup culture is one example of that. I just had to have that girl. Now I don't want to see her anymore.
Right.
And, you know,
that's, and I have an app on my phone that's going to find me 30 more.
Relationships is that they're purely contractual, short-term, and they don't create lasting community or relationship. And that's where I think the church needs to say, you know what, we are going to be a place where, you know, the 99 sheep can stay here. We're going to go out and get, but the 99 sheep have to be in a pen. And we have to emphasize the fact that there are not only rules, but there are ways of being a sheep. And those are the ways that are going to keep people in, and they're going to attract others.
Yeah,
because people aren't attracted to something that seems to say to them, oh, you can do exactly what everybody else is doing and still be Catholic. If what everybody else were doing was working, they wouldn't be looking at the church.
Right.
Exactly right.
That seems to be kind of a new ongoing debate of whether the church really ought to be going after that one and trying to find the stray sheep that are now out there in the culture to bring them back to the fold, or whether we need to be spending time rebuilding the pen and spending time within our churches, within the institutions that we have, sort of rebuilding and restoring. You know, that's kind of the whole idea behind Rod Dreher's Benedict option, that we've spent too long combating the culture, we've spent too long butting our heads against what's going on out there, and we've let our house fall into disarray. And so we need to spend some time on our own house, building things back up within our own churches, within our own parishes. Where on that debate do you kind of fall, Dr. Deevil?
Well, I mean, I agree with that. And I think Dreher has kind of, you know, he's made his caveats and his, I didn't really mean that. So, I think he's not saying exactly that we need to leave the public arena, but I think he's saying that there are certain time constraints that we have, energy, monetary constraints, and really the task is going to be to build up what's inside while still fighting the fights on the external world. But I think you're right, Mark. It's a case in which we have to be a place to which people will come. And, Father Ian Carr, who's a great Newman scholar, says in one of his books, he says, part of the problem about being saved is we can be saved from something, but, you know, the church provides a place to go for safety. And if we don't appear to be that place, then people aren't necessarily going to come to us. So that means that we need to build up these interior institutions. It's funny that, you know, Newman was often criticized in the 19th century because he was not one of these famous convert makers who brought them in by the dozens. And he spent much of his time in a working-class industrial city, Birmingham, where there were lots of Irish immigrants. He spent a lot of time teaching in the school that he and his fellow Oratorian fathers ran and running countless ministries to working-class people and building those people up who were already there, creating for them a church, a parish to go to, a spiritual home. And people did come to him, like Jesus. Our Lord in the Gospels always has these people approaching him. He doesn't necessarily approach them. The same way with Newman. He built something up, and people would come to him. Gerard Manley Hopkins, the famous poet, was one of them. When he was thinking about converting, he came and he spent a week with Newman and the Oratorian Fathers learning about things. And that's I think, a key for us, is providing that rest, that solace, that comfort, that shelter, that place for which people can come to actually experience what it means to be saved for something, in something.
So you had brought up this idea about the church being a place of safety and maybe even respite, what comes to mind to me. How big of a problem or how big of an impediment is, say, some of the challenges we're currently facing? We've got the renewed crisis in the church. How difficult is it for, in your estimation, for the church to carry this message forward now, given the sort of setting that we find ourselves in?
Well, I think it's very difficult for our big institutions because I think they aren't trusted to a certain degree. And the bishops, many of whom are good men, have not always shown courage or have not always shown the power to clean things up. So I think institutionally it's very difficult to do this. But I think this is where many of the new religious movements, the lay ecclesial movements, and just people in the parishes are so important. We don't need a bishop or a priest or, some public professional figure to create the kind of community that we have. We have the Eucharist, and then we have lots of ways in which people can set up communities. I mean, I'm going to a party this weekend for some friends. Every year since they've gotten married, they have a fall festival in which they invite all their friends to come. And their invitation is it looks like a church bulletin. And it's kind of like their Christmas letter. They tell what's been going on, but they've done it in the shape of a bulletin to indicate that we are the church, the domestic church. And they've gathered around them a huge number of friends, many of whom have been drawn to the faith or been drawn back to the faith. And those are things that all of us can do in our own place, is to be fed by the Eucharist and then to be Eucharistic ourselves, giving ourselves out to others and inviting them in and being responsive to them. It doesn't take the institutional structure to do that.
It seems that one of the things I want to connect that with is you have in your article towards the end, you have the headline, "The Church Rises Again," which I think is so beautiful and so hopeful. What are some additional themes or ways in which we can go about maybe stemming the tide a little bit and reconnecting around? I love that idea. In fact, I'm going to insist that Mark and his family begin a fall festival here locally that I can attend for free and bring my friends.
And we'll have beer.
And we will have beer. We'll have beer and pumpkin pie, maybe something, and a hayride.
I think the first thing is, the first thing is always prayer. And it's prayer that we would be able to see what's good. I mean, a former colleague of mine, a priest, he used to say, this is the thing, is that, in lots of ages of the church, as I said in my article, I think, the world probably seemed just as terrible to St. Augustine or to St. Leo or St. John Chrysostom as it does to us. And yet, we now look back on that and we see these little shoots of goodness. So I think the first thing is to pray, and pray that we would be able to see what God is starting now that may not bloom for 100 years, but that we need to be able to nourish. So I think that's the first thing, is to see. And then the second thing, I think, is to think, again, about what we can do on our personal level. And then thirdly, think about, I said we don't need those institutions to start that. But ultimately, any movement is going to create institutions. So we need to think very carefully about what institutions we really want to save and where there are opportunities for new institutions. I think on the we've talked about Catholic higher education. I think there's a huge opening for Catholic high school and lower ed schools, because many of the traditional parish schools have been run on that kind of Christendom, nominal nominal Catholicism model, and many of them are closing up. But there are huge openings. Dale Ahlquist, a friend of mine, president of the American Chesterton Society, he and a number of people started about 10 years ago a lay-run, independent, Catholic, classical school called Chesterton Academy. And it's, you know, they threw this thing together, you know, on a wing and a prayer. And now, you know, 10, 12 years later, I hear about new lay-run Catholic schools that are popping up everywhere, many of them called Chesterton Academy. There are ones in Chicago and Omaha and the West Coast. And then there are other things. So I think the building, thinking about the building of new institutions, I mean, in a way, being entrepreneurial, but entrepreneurial as people of faith is essential. Education is one. I think thinking about healthcare, care for the elderly and an aging population, all of these things are going to mimic what the church did in the first ages of the church. Educating, taking care of the poor, and then by doing that, opening people up to the great truth that it's Christ who is the great teacher and he is the great healer.
And he is the vine. And I think that's a key to all of this, that I think we often look at the church and we lose sight of the vine that we ought to all be attached to. You know, without a spiritual life, and I think Blessed John Henry Newman was a great example of this, without a solid spiritual life, in a lot of ways, the rest of it doesn't matter. It's going to bear fruit if you're connected to Christ, kind of no matter what it is. And on the other hand, if you're not connected to Christ, ultimately, you're going to get lopped off. It's going to drop off.
That's right. That's why I say the
lopped
part
off
is the first, you know?
Right.
Gerald Mann, who was a Dominican, his famous book is called The Divine Pity. It's about the Beatitudes. But in this book that he did right after World War II, he said, this has been the problem with this. This is why we keep stumbling into these world wars, is that we don't actually root our action in our prayer. And it's, he said, until all of our action is rooted in our prayer and all of our prayer is driving our action, we're going to be essentially those clanging cymbals who make a lot of noise but don't actually get anything done.
Well, and with the our prayer life, too, it's important to, I from my perspective, is to make ensure that we have our own individual personal prayer life,
that's
very vibrant. But also, we also need to pray together. So that's why things like mass attendance is so important. Obviously, there's the Most Holy Eucharist, but it's praying together at mass, being together at mass, opportunities to pray the rosary together, either as a family or part of your apostolate, let's say, at your local parish. And then also, I found extremely enriching over the years now, praying the Liturgy of the Hours is another way to join in. And boy, is it, we at our parish, before we begin any meeting in the evening during the week at the parish, we always start with evening prayer. And that might be the only time a lot of parishioners pray, even an hour of the office. But just to be a part of that, I found to be just very, very enriching.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I've been on your show before talking about Vatican II, and many people will talk about, you know, the unkept promises of Vatican II, and they'll usually mean something like women priests or some crazy thing like that.
Yeah.
But when I read those documents, one of the things that they say is they want the Liturgy of the Hours to be prayed publicly, particularly in cathedral parishes, but also other parishes, so that the whole people of God can take part in that liturgy, you know, as much as they can. And I think, you know, that's something that we could work on, is having more opportunities, like you say, for praying the Liturgy of the Hours together. You get the traditional life of the church in those praying those psalms, hearing those New Testament passages, and and lifting up our needs. And it's an incredibly enriching experience that I think makes then the Eucharist much more meaningful to us, because we're praying the prayers that kind of go around it, and we see the greater context in which the Mass takes place.
I've often, I completely echo that. It makes me wish, I think the biggest impediment that I've seen with that is, it's unless you're, when you're first introduced to praying the Liturgy of the Hours, especially whether it's morning prayer or evening prayer, it's very disorienting. It's very difficult to figure out when I'm saying the antiphons, the glory, The Gloria is a little bit differently, and just kind of moving around, especially if you incorporate specific feast days. If someone could simplify that a little bit, and I know there's a Christian prayer book, but even that requires some fancy footwork, if you will, to kind of get through it. That would be a big step forward in terms of promoting it.
You know, there are apps online. I think the digital age has simplified that quite a bit to where it is all, you know, daily put together for you in one place. So, universalis.org comes to mind. Other apps like that.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Give you what you need for the day, and that way you don't have to flip the pages to find
I need to do that.
Yeah, you need to step out of the cave every once in a while.
I need to get out of the cave and get over to Best Buy or something.
Well, I mean, you know, but some that technology. Brings up again something is that, you know, many of us, you know, lament this age and all of the technical distractions, and of course these things are all true, but at the same time we have these tremendous tools, you know, that we didn't have before, right, to have that, you know, the liturgy of the hours in our pocket. And, you know, to just with a you know, the press of a button, we've got the prayer of the church nice and organized for us. I mean, that's you know, and I think that's something too, is that, you know, I mean, like I say, I wrote this thing, how is, you know, we can be gloomy about this, but we need to see what's really good and really an opportunity for us.
Yeah, I was going to ask that, and, you know, we're running out of time a little bit here, but let's finish up. I want to ask you, of your four personality types, the glass is half full, the glass is half empty, wait a minute, who is somebody filling it up, or what's going on here, versus, hey, I think I ordered a cheeseburger. Dr. Deva, which would you consider yourself?
I think I tend to be the type who says, it's half full, it's half empty, no wait. What's the question again? Because I think, you know, the more we look at things, the more disorienting we are. Like I say, right now my feeling is that it's half empty and draining, but I mean, one of the things that I say in the article is that, what, you know, of course, you know, when we study the history of the church and even the history of God's Old Testament people, God seems to always be ordering a glass that's half empty and draining, and that's so that he can show that it's not us, but that he's the one who's at work behind us. And so we don't have to fear. We have to trust in him and wait for his salvation.
Well, we've been speaking once again with one of our great, great friends of the show, Dr. David Deevil, Associate Professor of Catholic Studies up there at St. Thomas Aquinas, or St. Thomas University up there. Well, it is after St. Thomas Aquinas.
Yeah, no, it's for St. Thomas Aquinas.
Okay, so ta-da! Every time I say Aquinas, I like to hear like the angels sing because he's my hero. And also, you're the editor of Logos Magazine, which I subscribe to. I highly, highly encourage people looking for a really solid, informative, well-written Catholic periodical. Logos is the way to go. How would we keep in touch with some of your upcoming work, projects, things that you're involved in?
You know, if you you can find me on Facebook. I also have an academia.edu account where I often post many of my articles. So you can find me there. I'm also on LinkedIn. And then you can also go to stthomas.edu/logos, L-O-G-O-S, and you can find the journal.
Great. And again, a big part of what we've been talking about today is your most recent article from posted there at the Catholic World Report, another online resource I highly recommend. And your article was called A True Antagonist for a Broken World, Faith in a Secular Age. Dr. Deevil, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, it's been great. Thank you.
You know us as Catholic Radio Indy, but we're so much more than just radio. We're a ministry reaching out to Central Indiana and beyond. We have information available about what's happening in parishes here in the Hoosier Heartland, as well as access to the latest from Rome, plus apologetics and authentic Catholic teaching. We are your source for 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
And that is all the time we have for the Catholic Cave for today. For Mr. Mark Tuttle, for Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, and our special guest, Dr. David Deevil, I'm Kent Blanford. Until next time, may God bless.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.